We talk food and cooking a fair amount here on The Exchange. Those discussions usually focus on the farm or in the kitchen. We don't often talk about the processes in between. Today we will, in a discussion about meat and its preparation for cooking. Rogue Valley resident Adam Danforth knows lots about slaughtering and butchering animals for eating. He studied slaughtering and butchery at the State University of New York, SUNY at Cobleskill in the heart of farm country. He holds butchering workshops across the country. His twin books on slaughtering and butchering, one on beef, one on pretty much everything else, came out 2 years ago and won James Beard Awards, high praise for works on food and food preparation. Adam Danforth, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So who are the books meant for?
Well, interestingly enough, butchering is a little bit of a classless craft, and therefore the books themselves...
As in it knows no class, not that it, yeah. Not the other sense.
Right. So it appeals to a wide range of people. Originally, I think the conception of the books was meant for homesteaders and farmers and meat enthusiasts. But with the lack of information available to a lot of people who are taking up a more recent interest in butchery and trying to bring that process back into their kitchens or into their life in general, the books themselves have appealed to a really broad range of people. So along with the homesteaders and the farmers, I'm also working with people who are dealing with hunters and using that information to apply it to game. I'm working with chefs from across the country, whether it be in very small kitchens or whether it be in some of the nicest and most lauded kitchens in the country. And also a lot of home enthusiasts, people who are looking to maybe not kill their own animals, but are looking to maybe get a side of lamb into their kitchen at home or prepare some bacon for the first time or something like that. And also for people who are dealing with meat distribution and who want to better understand where cuts are coming from and a little bit more about what makes meat and how they can get into that dialogue with their customers.
It's not a textbook per se. It's much more lavishly illustrated than that. But the level of knowledge here is fairly amazing. I mean, you're not just talking about cuts of meat, but you get right down to muscle fibers and what goes on within the muscle fibers and all that stuff. I mean, how long did you study?
Well, the program at Cobleskill was a shotgun program, really. The intent of the program was to address a dearth of people who know how to cut meat in small slaughterhouses. And one of the problems with local meat is that you have lack of accessibility of slaughterhouses, and that problem is compounded by a lack of people who really have the skill set in order to cut meat. So the SUNY Cobleskill program was meant to get people ready for entrance into slaughterhouses and then continue training in them. So I started in that, which didn't really give me that underlying foundation of the how. It was more the how and less the why. And the way that I try to think about things is more in the opposite way. Why do we do certain things that we do and have it inform the how of how to do things? So in my own personal interest, I ended up delving more into the anatomical and biological side of why certain things exist within meat. And I wanted to start with the kill because I wasn't comfortable working with carcasses unless I was comfortable creating them. Mm-hmm. So at the time, this was a little bit of an unorthodox approach to butchery. Most people came up through culinary routes, through kitchens, a lot of them. And I didn't come from a culinary background. I came from an advertising background. So when I entered into butchering, I was aiming to start from step one. And so what's informed me along the way and what informs the workshops that I teach is really why do we cut in certain places? How do we create better meat from an animal that's still alive? You know, why do we experience what we do when we eat meat? Why does something happen when we're preparing it in a certain way? And all that information is based upon science. So I back it up to that. And I try to give a brief overview with delving in deeper in certain areas, depending on how far people want to go with it.
Well, you know, there is an option for people to look at the parts they want to look at and not look at the parts they don't want to look at. And as you put right up in front of the book, slaughtering is not for everyone. And in fact, it sounds like you run across some people who do actually grow the animals and feed them and care for them. But when it comes to the slaughtering, they don't particularly want to do that part of it.
I think slaughtering is a really personal experience. And in order to do it, you sort of have to face certain fears or stigmas of your own. People who raise animals aren't necessarily equipped to kill them. And that may be one, they may not have the skill to do it, even though I feel like anybody can really do it if they if they sit down and learn. But they also may not have the emotional wherewithal to sort of put themselves through that at the time. So a lot of the workshops that I do around the country aim to address that. And a lot of the work that I do faces stigmas around the meat industry in general. And one of those stigmas is that slaughtering is potentially brutal or bloody or gross or going to be offensive or things like that. So I take people through the process on farms with farmers who are raising the animals that we're killing. And in a way in which I really allow people to let their guard down, and I try to hold that sort of vulnerable space so that they can interact with it and potentially have a really, I don't want to say life-changing, but really view-altering experience in which they're able to reconnect with the animals that sustain us much better than they had before, and maybe hopefully increase their reverence for those animals and in turn potentially eat less meat, which is one of my main goals.
Which I know that no vegetarian might understand, but you're talking about treating an animal humanely even through the process of killing it for meat.
Yeah, the workshops I do center around the well-being of the animal up until the point of death. And after the animal's dead, then the point of the workshop really centers around reducing waste of the animal and the carcass itself. And I get, you know, I work with a lot of vegetarians as well who are looking to better understand, you know, maybe why they eschewed meat to begin with, which a lot of the time has to do with practices of the industry. And the same go for vegans. So, you know, I engage in dialogue with those people really a lot. And I certainly, I'm open to it. I mean, my message of eating less meat, they eat a lot less meat.
We are talking to Adam Danforth, who's written a couple of books on butchering and talks about butchering and slaughtering and humane treatment of animals, but knowledgeable treatment of animals as well. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take your comments and questions if you'd like to join the conversation. Back with Adam Danforth, Butchering and You in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Adam Danforth, who knows a great deal about slaughtering and butchering of animals for meat, for food. And he's written a couple of books about those and scored some notable forewords. Temple Grandin gave the foreword in his book on butchering beef. And Joel Salatin from The Omnivore's Dilemma gave the foreword to his book on butchering pretty much every other animal out there. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about humane treatment of animals while they're being turned into meat. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You describe turning animals into food, Adam, as profound and cathartic. Is it something that... How did you approach it at first? Were you squeamish at first, or was it something you just took to right away?
I wasn't sure exactly how I was going to react the first day that I participated in a slaughter. I wasn't raised in a family that was hunters, and I wasn't really faced with death all that much, aside from pets. And the morning that I slaughtered an animal for the first time, we had to kill 14 lamb at 7 o'clock in the morning in this Sunni, in this slaughterhouse. And I sat in the parking lot at 6:30 and sort of gave myself a pep talk, thinking that I'd never killed anything before. Of course, this ignored the fact that I'd killed plenty of fish, which is a separate side of the conversation of how we relate to those. But I went through the process, and I was really fortunate to have some people who led me through it really well. There's a teacher named Eric Shelley, who still lives in upstate New York, who's a really excellent teacher, and his sidekick, Clint, and so they walked us through it, and they were also my teachers through that whole program. And by noon, when we had done those 14 sheep, and I volunteered first in order to cut one of the throats, which is how they end up in the end dying, I didn't want to stand around. The anxiety was sort of like getting to me. I wanted to be in the process immediately. So by the time we were done and it was noon, I was actually more shocked by how little I had been shocked by the process. And it felt really natural to me. And when I reflected on that later, I realized that early on in my childhood, I had also been around a dog at one point that had been hit by a car right in front of my house. And no one else had been there, and I saw this happen. And I alerted somebody to the fact that it was happening, and they were trying to find the owners and this and that. And I sat with that dog as it died. And there was no moment in which I had this this sadness necessarily. It was sort of this beautiful moment, which is the end of someone's life or something's life. And every time that I'm involved in a slaughter, I really continue to feel that way. And so it always, and this is one of the things about working with people who've never been on a slaughter before, is that they remind me of that first moment that you experience that. And they also remind me to step back and continue to have the same amount of reverence I had when I first approached it with the trepidation that maybe a novice does. So it helps sort of keep me in that place every time.
How close is the connection between how animals are treated and how they taste?
It's a direct correlation. There's no irony in the fact that an animal that lives a better life tastes better on the plate. If we're thinking about a couple things that have to do with meat, flavor, and texture afterwards, really we need to talk about two qualities, texture and flavor. The texture that everyone loves to talk about is tenderness. And if we think about what promotes tenderness in an animal when it's alive, because that's really what we have to consider, is like how the muscle fibers develop when the animal's alive. The things that promote tenderness are two things. You have less activity and you have younger age. And if you translate that into what an industry thinks, you have confinement, which is less activity, and then you have quickened growth so that they get to a point where their market weight quicker and quicker. So those are really play into the hand of the commercial meat industry. The things that really promote flavor are activity. So you have natural movement. You have animals that are outside on pasture, things like that. And you also have older age. You have slower growth animals. And if we add a third one to that, we can also add diverse diet. So the things that I try to promote with people is to understand, you know, we're eating animals. The better life we can give them when they're alive, the better they're going to taste. And even if you're not that concerned with animal welfare, if your focus is purely on flavor, then even supporting more welfare-oriented operations are going to provide you with a better tasting meat.
You also want to scare them, apparently, right before they are slaughtered, because that makes a big difference in texture and flavor there as well.
Yeah, there's a couple things that can go wrong preceding a slaughter. And one of them is it's a dramatic increase in adrenaline right beforehand that can cause really detrimental impacts to the state of the meat after death.
So we talked about muscles a bit. Are there certain parts of the animal that are going to be better? You talked about some activity, but not great activity. Is that right?
There's a lot of different experiences that you can have in a carcass depending on the function of the muscle. And the more muscle works in general, the more potential for flavor it's going to have. So if we think about areas of a quadruped, these four-legged animals, the areas that work the most are really those legs that have to hold up the body, maybe the abdominal walls, which are holding up all the guts against gravity, and also, let's say, the neck, which has to lean down and eat and pick up its head constantly. Those are the areas that work the most, and those are the areas that often provide the most flavor. But they're also the areas that require lengthier cooking times. And traditionally in America, we prefer to cook quick and easy. And the things that are quick and easy are things that are inherently tender and can't be messed up all that much, because we haven't ushered a culinary, you know, culture all that well through generations. So when we look to what is the most expensive cut that therefore people think is the greatest cut on an animal, and you look to the tenderloin. Well, the tenderloin is the least used muscle in the entire animal, and therefore it has the least amount of flavor, and it also has the probably arguably the worst texture of any muscle on the animal. So because it doesn't have any flavor, we have to prepare it with fatty sauces, or we wrap it in bacon, or we put a béarnaise sauce or something like that on it. But for other cuts that are inherently flavorful, we don't need to do that. You know, we can braise them, we can stew them, or we can take cuts like ones from the shoulder or maybe even ones from the rib section and just and cook those simply and have a lot more inherent flavor.
Adam Danforth is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's written a couple of books on butchering, which includes slaughtering, one on beef, one on poultry, rabbit, lamb, goat, and pork, photographic guides, which won James Beard Awards for his work. You can join our conversation on the Exchange if you have questions about slaughtering and butchering, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The idea that fat carries the taste in meat, you know, looking for the marbled meat, how much truth is there to that?
Fat provides the majority of the flavor that we're going to taste when we eat meat. And that could be inherent fat in the meat itself, or it could be based upon the fat that we cook the meat in. So a lot of the time I end up cooking meat in the rendered fat that comes from that same species. So I'll cook sheep in sheep tallow, I'll cook beef in beef tallow, I'll cook pork in lard, etc. The fat cells themselves are really just containers. They're empty containers. You can put anything that's fat soluble into them. And a lot of what comes into fat has to do with what they eat. So the more diverse feed that they have, the more access to things on pasture, stuff like that, the more diversity and flavor in the fat that they're going to have. And a lot of the time, the more healthy profile of fat as well. So I certainly encourage people to eat fat. I think that anything, it's a matter of moderation, but the healthier fats are really going to come from, I most of the time feel like, animals and some other healthy sources outside of that.
The book is so straightforward. I mean, you make us think about things that a lot of people who eat meat on a regular basis just never think about. Like the fact is that death brings about rigor mortis. And so how does that get into the butchering process? How do you have to deal with that?
Rigor mortis itself?
Yes.
Every animal, everything that is, especially mammalian, is going to go through rigor mortis. And so that the process of rigor mortis depends largely on the size of the animal and how long it lasts. But rigor mortis is like that final contraction. And if we think about our muscles in a contracted state, they're not going to be very tender. They're probably not going to be all that palatable. So really how we deal with that post-mortem is that we create an environment for the animal to more or less decay under a controlled environment. So the muscles all go into a permanent state of contraction. What we then do is control the breakdown of those muscles to a point which we prefer. And that could be aging beef, let's say 14 days, to some people aging, you know, parts of beef for 90 days, or, you know, taking it as long as you want. And the length that you age an animal has a lot to do with the size of it and also the color of the meat. So a general rule for me is the darker the meat, the longer you can age it, and the larger the animal, the longer you can age it.
What does the aging do? I mean, I'm surprised that, wow, 90 days, really?
Well, some people are taking middle meats, which are the sort of rib section of beef, and certainly aging them much longer than they may have in the past. The aging process itself, it undoes the work of rigor mortis. So that final contracted state never is undone. The animal never relaxes post-mortem. I mean, those muscles go into a permanent tough state. So really what we need to do is all those muscle fibers and connective tissues need to be broken down. And that happens by some rogue enzymes that go crazy potentially after death because they're not kept in check anymore by a live animal. And so the animal slowly decays. And if that animal were sitting in a field and it were 90 degrees, it would decay quickly. But considering that we keep it in a cooler at 36 degrees, it's going to decay much slower. And so we have a lot more control over that to time it in a way that meets whatever sort of palatability we're looking for.
We have a number of phone calls waiting for you. Let's go to Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Danforth. We're talking butchering.
Good morning.
Hi.
What kind of exercise do hogs raised in one of those giant hog farms get? Are they pretty well penned in and therefore don't get to move around much?
The typical hog operation is focused more on volume than anything that has to do with movement of the animals. So the majority of those lives for pork, and also if we think about poultry, the majority of those lives, if not every moment of those lives, is spent under the quote-unquote umbrella of a corporation. So from birth to death, and all of it is going to be spent indoors, in confinement, in very close situations, and as a result, you know, they're housed in these large indoor facilities, and you can see them actually on Google Maps sometimes when I go over areas of the country. You can see these large silos and these large long buildings that are pretty much always white and stacked next to each other, and then they have a what is called the lagoon of manure next to them. And the interior environment is so noxious with gases and other things that they really have to keep the movement of the air at the constant incredible speed inside. You hear some cases where, let's say, the power goes out and the fans die and you have thousands of animals that perish really quickly because the environment inside those buildings is just really inhospitable for anything. So the pork especially, the lack of movement means that the meat is going to be more tender. It's also going to be lighter in color. It's also going to require less fat. And those are some of the things that have come about for the pork industry in the last several decades, most notably probably in the 70s when we started to move towards leaner meat and they called it the other white meat. And when you really look at pastured pork, and sometimes when I'm doing workshops or people see photos of pastured pork that I post, the response sometimes is that looks like beef. And that's because animals that move require more blood flow. They have deeper color in their meat and they need more nutrients and all these other things. So when you see really well-raised pork, it's going to have a far different color than anything that's raised in captivity.
More questions here or more comments here. Obviously, this is a very non-industrial farming look at things in the book Butchering by Adam Danforth. Here's John in Washington, D.C. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, Adam. John Wilkes. How are you?
Hi, John.
You can't keep a good man down. Adam, very quickly, I don't know if you've been talking about the idea of eating older meat on this show as yet. I know you're a huge fan. And I just wondered, do you see any difference between eating, say, beef from an older heritage breed compared to a more, a commonplace breed of animal? Just your thoughts. Interested.
All right. Thanks for that, John.
Yeah, thanks for your question, John. John is also on the board of an important organization called the Livestock Conservancy for people who are interested in heritage breeds. They're good to look up. The question was about older animals between heritage and more common breeds, and there certainly is a difference, I feel like, in consuming older animals that come from heritage breeds or really heritage breeds in general. There's an aspect of the genetics and how they have muscle conformation and how they put fat on and things of that nature. Despite that, I really feel that husbandry has more to do than breed. You can certainly produce, let's say, I would feel better meat with the combination of great husbandry and great genetics. But if you're raising animals on your farm and you don't have heritage breeds, you can still have excellent quality meat as long as you follow great practices that deal with husbandry and center the well-being of the animal during the course of its life and ensure that it has a low-stress kill. The question of older animals was also plays into what I was talking about greater flavor and other things like that.
Another question here from Boyd in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Danforth.
Good morning. I found it interesting you talking about your first day slaughtering, where there was 14 lambs. And I wonder how you would keep the number 2 through 14 from either smelling blood or just feeling the fear or something, that after that first lamb is slaughtered, the others know that that's going to happen pretty soon. So how do you keep that adrenaline rush you talked about that you don't want?
All right. Thanks for that, Boyd.
In a slaughterhouse, there's a lot of different ways that a slaughterhouse is designed. The one that I was in was a very small one, and you have a single animal chute. So the animals are being kept actually outside of the slaughterhouse in a pen that they've been in, hopefully for at least 24 hours or so to acclimate before that. One at a time is brought into the chute and brought into the actual slaughter room. At that point, they're separated, and the other animals aren't witness to anything that's happening. And then the animal is knocked and then bled. When I do them in a field, I make sure that I do sheep in two at a time at least. I transport them away from their flocks, and I do it at two at a time because they are herd animals, and separating a single sheep away from a flock creates a much larger stress response than separating them in pairs. With that being said, I have had to to kill an animal amongst the flock before. And there is the initial startling of mostly that comes from the use of a captive bolt gun, which is what I used to stun before bleeding. But soon after death, you can see that the animals, they go back to a pretty low stress state. And actually, some of them are quite curious about what's happening, and they come over and investigate the scene themselves. So there isn't much objection to it, other than the things that are unnatural in the environment. I think a lot of the time when we feel that animals are going to create fear around witnessing a death has to do with our own projection. Nonetheless, I go to great lengths to prevent that from being a factor in the workshops that I do, and I do try to separate them from smell or visual of what's happening.
Well, it's clear that you use a lot of the animal too from the charts that you give. So a lot of work goes into this, but a lot of work you've shared with us in a couple of books now. Butchering Beef is one book by Adam Danforth. The other one is Butchering Poultry, Rabbit, Lamb, Goat, and Pork, The Comprehensive Photographic Guide to Humane Slaughtering and Butchering, which won a James Beard Award. Congratulations, and thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson
Exchange. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.